Welcome back, everyone.
Hey, guys.
We're so excited.
This is episode 5 of the podcast.
Getting towards the end. Crazy.
I know. So today we have a super special guest, Dr. Rizkala. And she's here to talk about her research and just a little bit about what she's been up to, how to conduct research, and all interesting things. So thank you so much for being here.
Yeah,
so
thank you for having me.
We'd love to start out with maybe just like a quick intro for anyone who might not know you. Just like how long you've been at Pepperdine and what you teach, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, sure. This is my 8th year at Pepperdine, which is pretty crazy. It feels like it's gone by fast. I'm a professor in international studies, and my research is about post-war politics and kind of both at the political but also the social level, kind of how people put back the pieces and what the legacies of conflict are. I'm also interested in how people come together or mobilize across identity groups in societies that, quote unquote, we call really divided societies along some sort of identity, you know, line. I teach, I don't know, comparative politics, yeah. Middle Eastern politics, conflict and peace building. I'm the advisor for the Global Tides Journal. Yeah, I love being part of ISL.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, we love it too. We hear so many wonderful, amazing things about you all the time from everyone.
Thank you.
So I think we'll start out maybe with just touching on your most recent research, if you could give us just sort of like an overview about what it was about, what you found, how you found it.
Yeah, what made you interested in it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, so I guess the thing that I've published most recently is it's about urban politics after war, and it's actually part of my dissertation that I finally got out. Just, you know, put it on, had laying on my desk for a long time. It's a piece that really relies on field work, and that's kind of my favorite part of research. I also do quantitative, you know, statistical work and, like, stuff that happens at a desk, but my favorite part is getting to go into the field and talk to people and, you know, do a little bit of almost oral history along the way of writing the articles. So this piece is very much in that vein. And this piece talks about how the ending of the civil war in Lebanon, which is a country I do a lot of research in, the civil war in Lebanon went on from 1975 to 1990. And so my research looks at what happened after the war ended and how these kind of urban enclaves that were controlled by different armed groups and different militias, like how they fared after the war ended. And so I found that, Lebanon was a case that had a lot of foreign intervention in order to end the war. I don't think it would have ended that way or at that time without the intervention of the Syrian regime. And so with the blessing of a lot of other countries in the world. And so if you were kind of on Syria's side as an armed group, it seemed that the locations that you controlled, like you were able to kind of keep consolidated control of those locations. And that meant that politics in those areas looks pretty authoritarian, kind of like a single party dominant party type of system after the war. And then neighborhoods where the group that was in control lost the war or was somehow defeated or repressed by the intervention and the way the war ended, those groups ended up leaving a political vacuum, right, when mm-hmm. they were repressed or destroyed or whatever mm-hmm. happened to them. And that actually counterintuitively leads to more kind of pluralism and some forms of democracy today in those places, because what you ended up having is these kind of traditional leaders that were relevant before the war started kind of started popping up again and reasserting their control and taking advantage of the fact that there was a power vacuum at the level of like an armed actor. And so what I was trying to explain was why some neighborhoods that were just a 15-minute drive from other neighborhoods were completely authoritarian and controlled by one political party and with, like, no really, very little room for dissent. And then, you know, you get in your car, drive 10 or 15 minutes, and there's a neighborhood where there's, like, multiple parties fighting it out in elections yeah. And local kind of traditional elites, you know, and I think in some parts of the world they call them, like, village chiefs, but in Lebanon we just call them the families. but, like, why they were really influential, again, in these places, whereas in the places where the party had control, the families had become totally irrelevant. So it's just, like, this really, I kind of call them, like, post-war political orders, because it encapsulates a lot. It's not just, like, one little outcome. And I was kind of wanted to explain this difference. Like, what is going on here?
Yeah.
And a lot of it had to do with the outcome of the war. But the part that I found really interesting, honestly, was how that outcome impressed itself upon these, like, neighborhoods and on the micro level. Mm-hmm. And I really like research that's rooted in what's happening on the ground. I definitely have, like, a bias towards that. I like reading that, and I like writing it as well. I think it's because I like talking to regular people. And something interesting that I found in this paper is, okay, so we found this different outcome and that it's rooted in the foreign intervention. But the part that's, I think, more interesting is, or just as interesting, is that displaced people that had moved into these urban neighborhoods. So there was a lot of displacement in the Lebanese Civil War, which is not uncommon. I think more than a third of people were displaced kind of permanently.
Wow.
And both of these urban neighborhoods were, like, tiny villages before the war, and they became these, like, really congested, like, just full of people places.
That's so,
like, very, you know, very densely populated. And in both areas, I think something like 85% of the people are, like, can trace their family roots to, like, a displaced family from the 80s or the 70s. And only 15% would call themselves, you know, people that have family roots in the area before the war. Now, why that's interesting is that the people that have the family roots are the only ones that are allowed to vote in the area. So only 15% of the neighborhood gets to vote in the
wow.
neighborhood. Everyone else, if they wanted to vote, would have to go back to their villages of origin. And this is really strange for us in the West, but there are other countries where this is the case, where, like, voting registration is really tied to, like, where your family
from.
Of origin is from, not where you happen to live today. So that does really weird and dysfunctional things to the chains of accountability in local politics, as you can imagine. And if elections matter, then what you think is that the original people, which I hate that term because it's kind of really loaded and implies that they belong more than these
right.
other people do, which is not necessarily the case. But we'll call them the pre-war residents, that they have a lot more political power, right? Because
yeah.
they're the ones
yeah.
that vote. But what's fascinating is that in a post-war context in which a lot of the displaced people have stronger ties to the parties that kind of came out of the armed groups, because those groups kind of kept them safe during the war and sometimes
mm-hmm.
helped them resettle and sometimes recruited from these displaced communities that had experienced a lot of trauma. So you find that the displaced people, even though they don't vote in these areas, they're able to use their connections to political parties to pressure their local leaders kind of from the top down, like in an indirect way,
wow.
through their connections in the parties. And what's really interesting is that in the place where the families are irrelevant and the political party is in dominant control, the displaced people who don't vote in the area are actually more politically influential than the people who have voting rights in the area.
That's crazy.
And it's like a little, it's an indication of how little elections matter in that
right.
place and how that's held in an authoritarian
yeah.
way. So so it's not a paper that's like, this is the X and this is the Y. It's more of a paper that maybe has a less traditional format and is really trying to explain a cluster of things that, like, go together that explain why this neighborhood looks really different than this neighborhood after award.
Yeah. That is so interesting. Yeah,
that's crazy. So that's the one that just came out. Yeah.
I have kind of a follow-up question as I was hearing about this. So if there's like neighborhoods 15 minutes away from each other that are kind of being run in two different
ways. Yes.
How does that function on like a bigger level for the state of like, how do they work together on like, what
it's
is it? Like,
a total
bigger
mess, honestly. That would be the short version of it. But it is true. Like I have other work that I'm going to be working on this summer that's kind of a follow on or a spinoff that looks at the national level, and you can see really clear patterns of like whole regions of the country where elections are not competitive at all and where everyone knows who's going to win, and whole parts of the country where it is like really up for grabs. Mm-hmm. And so you literally live in different political ecosystems. It's interesting. I've had some critics tell me like, well, isn't the United States like that? Like there are places that, you know, election outcomes are foregone conclusions, mm-hmm. and others where they're not. And I think there is something to that. You know, but I think there is a difference between, I think part of it has to do with like how our primary system allows for democracy inside of maybe one side of the political spectrum. And so voters still get a chance to, mm-hmm. you know, get a say, even if everyone is conservative or everyone is liberal. Right. And that's really not what's going on in these places. Like what's going on in these places is that there is a party that has what we call an uneven playing field. Like it is, right. you know, it has rigged things in its favor. And then other places where, you know, you have elections that are really close, and it's mm-hmm. it's really interesting.
That is. Yeah. Is there like a noticeable difference between people who live in one neighborhood that is super authoritarian versus mm-hmm. a neighborhood very close by that's democratic? Can you like notice a difference in the people or?
Yeah, I mean, well, in this case, in this particular case in my paper, the neighborhood that's kind of controlled in an authoritarian way is a Shia Muslim neighborhood controlled by Hezbollah. But then the neighborhood that's really competitive is predominantly Christian neighborhood, and the people competing for power there are all the, you know, two or three different Christian kind of political parties. So Lebanon's very kind of, its politics is very kind of divided along religious lines for institutional reasons and historical reasons. Mm-hmm. But that's not the case all over the country. Like there are places that, like I think the areas that are predominantly Shia Muslim, you're hard pressed to find a lot of genuine competition. But that's just because those are the parties that were allied with Syria, and they kind mm-hmm. of were given free rein to kind of consolidate control after the war ended. But you look, for example, in Sunni Muslim areas where there isn't, like, there was actually a lot of tension with the Syrian regime, and the groups that maybe, quote unquote, represented those communities during the war ended up actually losing and not being relevant after the war ended. Like, you see a lot of kind of competition and uncertainty in those elections too. And so I don't think it necessarily has anything to do with religion, but it is true that in different communities you find different patterns of political competition. Mm-hmm. I think it has a lot to do with like happened in each of those communities during the war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you find that people are kind of too quick to assign a lot of those differences to religion? Like
absolutely.
When they kind of look at it, you know, just from a, oh, I don't really know too much. You know,
yeah.
They're like, it's religion. Like that
right.
must be, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So definitely.
That's
like the predominant like narrative about especially this part of the world. And I consider it partly my mission to like try to bring evidence to bear on the situation. And sometimes that evidence shows, wow, like religious identity is so important for understanding things. But you know, a lot of the time it doesn't. And a lot of the time you see other things going on. And I think, so in this study, I like, on the Shia Muslim neighborhood side, I actually looked at four little neighborhoods inside of the general area, and two of them were Christian neighborhoods that had become Shia neighborhoods because of displacement during the war, mm-hmm. and two were always Shia neighborhoods that had stayed Shia neighborhoods, and you found the same dynamic between, like, displaced people and people that were pre-war residents in both. Obviously, it's, like, more dramatic yeah. in the one where there's a religious difference and there's, like, another layer of, you know, complication or tension. Mm-hmm. But the same kind of dynamic about who is politically powerful obtained in the place where everyone is Shia and even the pre-war residents are. So I wanted to design it in a way that you could see that this was a dynamic that was not just, like, you know, because these people were from different religions right. than the people yeah. they displaced mm-hmm. or something. It's not so much about that.
Yeah.
Is there clear tensions between the displaced people and the pre-war residents?
There definitely used to be in the first 10, 20 years after the war. I think so much has happened in the region since the Lebanese Civil War mm-hmm. ended that you do see other things kind of eclipsing that now. Like, in the paper, I talk about how the 2006 war between Hezbollah and Israel was, like, a moment when people in the southern suburbs of Beirut, which are the Shia Muslim case study area, like, people really came together because they were both under threat together. And so the differences between who was a historic kind of resident of the city of the area versus a person who had come during the war who had voting rights and who didn't, like, those things kind of became more muted as people kind of were living in a crisis together. And so I think as time has gone on and other challenges have come up, that these differences have kind of become more muted, but they're not totally gone. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that people live fairly well together now, but I was just, yeah, trying to explore, you know, how they made sense of that when half of them yeah. voted, or more than half of them didn't vote in the area, and half right. and some did.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah.
And then you talked a little bit about before how there's some research that you haven't fully completed it, but you've mm-hmm. started to, you know, get some evidence for a result yeah. from. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So there's a paper that I'm working on right now with a co-author. Her name is Christiana Pereira. She is a professor at the Geneva Graduate Institute. And she generously, like, is letting us work together on some of her dissertation survey data that she didn't analyze this kind of piece of it. And it kind of fits better with the things that I know from a substance perspective. And so that sometimes things happen like that. So she has the data, and she collected data on people's Civil War histories kind of as a control variable for something else she was interested in. And I was like, you have this data now. We should ask these questions. Right? And she's like, yeah, let's do it. And so it's at a combining kind of my, like, substantive area of expertise with her data. And we're working together to kind of write this paper using that. So that paper, we're just in the early stages, but we're looking at how people's history as Civil War combatants, if they were older, or people's history as an active participant in the war. She has questions about whether you were, like, politically or administratively involved with one of the sides, you know, in the conflict. We're looking at how that shapes your politics today, for some people, 50 years after their experience wow. of fighting. Maybe they fought when they were 25 in 1975, and, you know, now they're, you know, a lot older. So we find, like, a very strong correlation that if you fought during the war with one of the sides or participated somehow, that political identity is very sticky, and that many decades later, you would still be voting that way very consistently. You're much more likely to vote at all. And oh, wow. you're, like, much more likely to be a party member and to vote for a party with a wartime history versus a new party that has emerged. And then the part that I think is even more interesting is that we found that the result is just as strong if it was your father rather than you.
That's
wow. So it's not like young people are striking out on their own and voting in a particular, in a different way. I mean, some are, and I think that you might see that in families that were not really involved politically, but anyone that has like an activist background in their family or their parent fought, they are voting very consistently today for these parties, you know, and we sometimes, I think what motivated this project was in 2019, Lebanon had this massive protest movement, and it was massive, but it wouldn't unseat the regime. Mm-hmm. And we were like, you know, like everyone's like, what's it gonna take, you know?
Yeah.
And then there was this massive explosion at the port of Beirut in August 2020, and it was totally because of government negligence. And there's all this evidence that came out about government corruption, and then the currency collapsed.
Oh, wow.
So people lost everything. There was an economic collapse that was like top three worst in the world since 1850.
Oh my gosh.
So like my family, you know, they've lost everything basically. And so there's all these like crises piling on top of each other, and still the regime feels immovable. But when you look at the data, most people are not voting.
Mm-hmm.
They're like checked out, you know, or if they vote, they're voting. There is a group of people that is voting for the parties like purely out of a material kind mm-hmm. of like their votes are being bought in one way or another,
yeah.
whether it's a position in this ministry for your kid or a place in the school for your kid or money, cash, like so that definitely is happening, and that's part of the story, is the cash flow that these parties have.
Mm-hmm.
But there is like a core of supporters that all these parties can rely on that turn up for them in elections. And we think that this has something to do with the legacy of the war.
Mm-hmm.
And that there are these like core people that are really enmeshed inside the party and its networks. They like fought for the party during the war. They're not going to abandon it anytime soon,
mm-hmm.
no matter how corrupt maybe its top officials are. It's like an identity question for them. And so I think that this puzzling, like, what the heck? Like, when is this going to,
yeah.
this regime going to be overthrown? I think part of the question is like how, or part of the answer is how kind of resilient some of these identities and some of these networks that were forged in the fire of war really are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then with the other piece of that puzzle of like, why is nobody else voting? Have you guys
mm-hmm.
kind of like figured out some
I think there's just
that?
A lot of apathy and a lot of
mm-hmm.
like, oh, it's not going to make a difference
right.
if we do vote. So for among people that don't rely on the parties for any material benefit,
mm-hmm.
and there is like a class correlation, a little, you know, there is a class distinction here. Like if you look at the protesters, they're fairly mixed, but I think there is this idea that the people who are leading the protest are more middle class or even upper middle class and have the luxury to be kind of detached
mm-hmm.
from these, you know, party networks and what
right.
they offer. I think that's a little bit of a generalization. But so I think there's just a lot of people that are checked out that are just like, this is a broken system and there's no way to get
right.
rid of it. And so like, why even vote?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a sad mindset. It's so hard to break
yeah.
people out of it's that,
it's very
too.
Difficult,
yeah.
yeah.
Especially when it seems like hopeless.
I mean, it's starting. In the last election in Lebanon, there was a big, like, civil society opposition movement that kind of created a coalition together, and they won, like, 11 seats in the parliament. And it's not enough to change party politics, but it was the first time they tried, and
yeah.
so
oh, that's
it'll
awesome.
Be interesting to see what happens. In
yeah.
the next elections.
When are there next elections for everyone interested in
oh,
updating
I
on
interested,
this?
Yeah, I think they are supposed to be coming up soon, but you never know. Because the establishment parties definitely feel the heat, and so sometimes they make moves to delay elections and to change. Yeah. So the last parliamentary elections were in 2022. So it definitely, they're not up for, they're not scheduled again till 2026. But, you know, it's anyone's guess whether they will actually happen in 2026. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
Do you have any advice for people who are interested in starting research or what topics they should delve into? Like, how do they know what's right for them?
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. It's a broad topic.
How did you get involved
in it? Yeah. I mean, I think that research is, strangely, it's a really personal thing. Like, what motivates you? I sometimes do the capstone senior research seminar for INTS, and I can see a lot of connections between the topics that students choose and like their backstories or their passions, something about, you know, what they're interested in. So my best advice is if you're actually thinking about becoming a researcher to make sure that you're researching things that are interesting to you, because I think that's a really powerful internal source of motivation. When you hit dead ends, when things are not working well, or when it's like, it feels like, you know, there's like mundane parts of the process, or you're like buried in some archive somewhere and you're like, what am I doing with my life? So I think it's important to have some sort of intrinsic motivation for your topics. Otherwise, I think it's really hard to sustain a long-term kind of commitment to those research areas. So I knew I wanted to do something in politics or political science early in college. I didn't know what it was. And I thought, oh, maybe I will go to D.C. Maybe I'll work in politics. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll be a lawyer. I don't know. You know, like there were all these like vague ideas in my head. But my dad was a professor and totally different. I mean, he taught MBA students, but I liked his relationship with his students. Mm-hmm. And I thought that he was making a difference. And so, and I also interned in DC at the Brookings Institution when I was your age. And I really liked that and did not like going to the Hill. When I would go to the Hill for hearings, I'd be like, this is really stressful.
Not where I want to be.
It's not my... And it also, it bothered me that people made policy decisions on just, like, thin evidence.
Yeah.
Like, quickly. Like, I just did not like that. And I was like, I want to get to the truth. Like, I want to get to the bottom of what is going on. Mm-hmm. And it's probably a personality thing that, like, I don't want to give advice to a policymaker unless I am really confident that what I'm saying is grounded in what's real.
Yeah.
I think a lot of things out there could be fixed with that.
A scary thing to
do. I had this anxiety about just, like, making decisions on the fly without the data, and I felt like politicians were doing that, and I was like... I can't be in this field.
Ignorance is bliss.
Yeah, exactly. So that was an experience that kind of solidified that I wanted to do research. And then I saw my dad enjoying kind of mentoring students. And so I think when I put the two together, I realized, oh, I think I should go get my PhD. But then I went into grad school thinking, I want to do anything but Lebanon. And I want to do anything but any stuff that like touches my family personally. My family's from the deep south of Lebanon. They've experienced all the dramatic changes, you know, that part of the country has undergone, military occupation, war, you name it. Insurgencies, whatever. All of it they've lived through and they've experienced the costs of, and I was just like, I'm not doing that. I'm going to do something about, you know, authoritarian politics. I'm maybe in the Gulf, maybe in North Africa. You know, I just was like, I knew I wanted to do the Middle East, but I was like, I'm not touching this war thing with a 10-foot pole. And then it just like, I couldn't shake it. Mm-hmm. And I even did my like master's thesis about something else. I took my classes and other things, and then I was in this like more general survey class, and we had a day on Civil War, and we read this like lit review that basically had this one line in it. I'll never forget it. That was like, the social and political, as opposed to the economic, which we knew more about. Like, the social and political legacies of civil war are poorly understood. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, they really are. And I think that's really interesting. And I hate that I think that's really interesting.
Never say never.
And then my advisor kind of, she encouraged me to face the music. And she's like, you do want to do something about Lebanon. You're just scared to do it because you think you won't be objective and that you'll get too emotionally wrapped up in mm-hmm. what you're finding. But she's like, I think that is the stuff that's going to make you go the distance, yeah, you know, yeah, with it. Yeah. And yeah, so that's kind of how, and it was late. It was like 3.5 years into grad school, like switch, big pivot.
But you did it.
So follow that, like, if there's an internal curiosity inside of you that like cannot be satisfied about something, that's probably a good sign that you should do research about it.
Yeah, yeah. I love that. Yeah. That's a cool way to come to research.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think for a lot of people too, like even myself, I'm so interested in just terrorism as a whole.
Yeah.
And then I'm from New York City, so it's like, you know, the whole 9/11 thing. I've just grown up hearing about it. And I didn't think about that at all, but it's like so true, just being surrounded by that. Everyone I know has been affected by it. And so that totally could play a part in why I'm so interested about it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who knew that deciding your research topic was like this deep dive into, who I am. And very introspective. Yeah, for sure.
Well, awesome. I think that is all the time we have for today. But thank you so much. We learned a lot.
You're very welcome.
It was so interesting.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.